Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m. It's Thursday. That means Triple Play Thursday. Get your request in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. That's also the number for talk and text for any time you want to jump in here. We're going to be talking 90s-related stuff, forgotten 90s teen TV shows, things that only kids of the 90s would appreciate, and the 25 coolest things that you ever owned in the 90s. The reason why we're doing this is as a tie-in to Captain Marvel, which opens tonight, a movie I'm really looking forward to, and it takes place in 1995, smack dab in the middle, so we thought we'd celebrate the 90s a little bit. We'll talk a little bit about brand loyalty and much more here, all coming up on the show. Right now, though, we want to welcome back to the show our good friend Rod Pyle. He is a space expert, speaker, and author of many books. He's got two new ones coming out that are sitting right in front of me, and they're beautiful. And we're going to talk about the two new books, plus any other and all related space stories. And let's welcome Rod back to the show. Hi, Rod.
Hey, Nick. How are you?
Good, good, good. It's been a while.
It's been a while, and since we last spoke, we've seen the advent of Ms. Captain Marvel.
Yes, I'm very excited about it. I mean, I happen to be a really, like, I have an unhealthy kind of obsession with Brie Larson. So...
So how could it be unhealthy?
No, it's not unhealthy. I just think she's lovely. And she's been making the rounds on the talk shows and just been charming and just wonderful. And I think I love her in everything. And I'm very excited to see this movie.
So have you seen any previews or anything? I haven't seen a bit.
Trailers and stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think it looks terrific. I'm seeing it in IMAX on Saturday, and I'm very excited about it. So.
All right. Well, yeah. I envy you.
So I understand you're on the road.
I'm on the road. I left Southern California last week in 50-degree weather and got to Tucson for the Festival of Books, which was grand, 130,000 people and
many-filled
sessions for us authors, which are rare, and we appreciate those.
Incredible.
At 80 degrees, and then got to Des Moines, Iowa a couple of days ago for a conference here, and it was 7.
Ah.
Fresh, thin-skinned California boys, that's cold.
It's pretty cold, but you're missing some insane weather in California right now. There's been insane thunderstorms and unbelievable showcases of lightning. I mean, like, really spectacularly scary.
You know, and they have to do that while I'm gone, because I like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
My ex used to, like, run to the closet when there was thunder and lightning, but I had an experience in eighth grade where lightning struck the flagpole outside our junior high school and shattered the windows. It was about 20 feet from the window.
Wow.
You're sitting next to, I think. And, you know, nobody got hurt, but it was like, hey, that's scary. Ooh, that's kind of cool. There was just this little smoking stem on the top of the flagpole where the ball used to be.
Wow.
So I have a healthy respect. But, yeah, you know, I think I'm not a big believer in the whole end times thing, but this weather is a little out of control.
It's been crazy. I mean, it really has been. Here in the Midwest, we've had this winter will not end. Rod, it just will not end. I mean, we had wind chills last week, 10 below, and then 2.5 weeks ago, we went through the polar vortex with 50 to 60 below wind chill.
And that's the kind of thing where if you stand outside for 10 minutes and not completely bundled up, it'll just kill you, right?
Exactly right. And I mean, it just won't end. It's been a miserable winter here. I mean, we're March 6th, and we're not even at freezing right now. It's like 20-something degrees outside.
Well, my friend, we need to promote space-borne solar power. So we get those big satellites up there. We start beaming power down to the planet collected from the sun. Stop burning fossil fuels, and life will be beautiful.
I would hope that would happen. Give everybody the old background on Rod Pyle, as we do every time we talk to you.
The Rod Pyle background. So I was born with the space age in the late 1950s, and was of just that perfect age to grow up with the programs of the space race. So I watched the Soviet Union and United States battle it out for the dominance of the heavens, trying to get to the lunar landing. And I was just the right age to be able to sort of get engaged with the Gemini program mid-stride, and then really was just Apollo fanatic. And the sort of end cap to that, I guess, was earlier today, I did a panel here at this conference in Des Moines, and we had three Apollo astronauts there and a flight controller. So we had Walt Cunningham from Apollo 7, the first crewed Apollo mission, Jerry Griffin, who was flight controller for all the lunar landing flights, Fred Hayes of Apollo 13, of course, the guy who was shivering and suffering in the lunar module in the movie and in reality. And Al Worden, who was the command module pilot on Apollo 15. And I tell you, man, if you got to stand up and talk to four people who are going to be interesting for an hour, you really can't beat that crowd.
That's really amazing, man.
That was everything I could do just keep from shaking while I was talking to guys because it was cool.
Well, you know, Buzz has written the forewords for your two latest books, which I think is awesome.
Yeah, he was very cool about it. So Space 2.0 was a book that I've been trotting around for a few years via my agent, who's a wonderful guy, and we'd gotten the interest of a number of publishers, but, you know, sometimes you have to get over that last hurdle of providing some risk reduction, and there was some concern about would the book earn out, and how would it sell, and all that. So I went back to the National Space Society, with whom I'd worked in various capacities for years as a volunteer, and said, would you be interested in underwriting this book? And a gentleman there named Stan Rosen said, yeah, I'll take a shot at it. So we raised some money, and Buzz is on our board of governors of that organization. So after we got the deal with Ben Bella Books and we're going along, we said, hey, what would you think about writing a foreword? Because we think it's an important book. It's forward-looking, next 20 years in space, really trying to, you know, look at the strengths of what we've been doing and where we're going. And he said, sure. So he wrote that, and then he also wrote one for my Apollo book that's coming out in April. So I am deeply indebted to that man.
By the way, I have both books in front of me, the Space 2.0 and the first On the Moon Apollo book. And one of the things about your books, besides them being like fascinating and well written, they are beautiful. Like it's, you know, this Apollo book is just absolutely beautiful. It's a beautiful coffee table book and great artwork in it and everything.
And both those companies, so that's Sterling, and then, as I said, Space 2.0 is Ben Bella. I feel like they really pulled out the stops this time. I think with Space 2.0, it's because they felt, and I feel, of course, as the writer, because you always do, that we had something special, because it's a really new area that hasn't been that much written about, at least not in this way, this survey of new space and what's ahead. And on the Apollo book, you know, just... there's a lot of them this year. They reissued a couple of my old ones. Yeah. One of them I didn't even know they had reissued until somebody called and said, hey, your book's out again. And I went, huh, what? And, you know, all the other authors that have been writing about it over the years have got books out. So they wanted to find a way to sort of differentiate it. So visually, they went all out, and then I got a couple of stories and angles in there that haven't really been looked at much before, including talking to some of the kids of the astronauts in that mission. So that was a really fun thing. We talked about that before.
We're going to dive into your books a little bit later on, but we have some space stories, some recent space stories that we want to get into. But I also want to ask you, speaking of Apollo, have you seen the documentary Apollo 11? It's playing in theaters right now here in Chicago.
So I haven't seen that one yet. I saw the trailer and it looks amazing. And because I worked on the Nat Geo one a little bit. Uh-huh. I didn't work on the one you're talking about.
Yeah.
And the Nat Geo doc, we were looking for anything in 35mm, and it's very hard to find, and there wasn't much of it. And those guys grabbed it and just did a sensational job of retransferring it. The Nat Geo one that comes out in a couple of months is a different approach. It's a whole program. It's not just Apollo 11. But they set that one in the time, so there's no voiceover, no narration. It's all just straight stuff from as if you were there. So very different approaches, but I think those are going to be the two capstone ones for the year.
Yeah. Well, that's very cool. I love the fact that the documentary of Apollo 11, it's playing in a bunch of theaters. It got a really nice big release, which is really, you know, really kind of unusual for a documentary. But I mean, it goes to show you just how important this mission was in history.
It shows you that. It shows you that they'd like to be considered for an Oscar.
Yeah. So, you
know, I mean, if you're smart, you go to the theater. So the other one's going to be released in theaters too. So yeah, they'll be head to head this year.
That's great. That's really great. I didn't get to see it over the weekend this past weekend, but I'm planning on seeing it. And one of my I review movies here on Monday mornings with two other film critics, and one of my other colleagues saw it and said it was just terrific. He really, really, really enjoyed it. So.
It's great, you know, and as I was talking to those four guys today, the astronauts and the flight director, I had to say, I felt kind of like an idiot saying it, but I said, you know, you guys were almost as far away from the Apollo 11 landing as it was for the first flight of the Wright brothers. It won't be too many more years before we're equidistant. And the further away I get from that experience, which I had when I was 11 years old, I guess, it's almost harder for me to believe it ever happened.
Right.
Because it's still hard with today's technology. When you think of what they had then, it's just mind-numbing, A, that it worked, and B, that we never lost anybody in space, at least not till the shuttle, and that they pulled that off. I mean, it was just operating on the thinnest of margins, on the very edge of what was possible, and this kind of a film really brings that back. That's how I felt when I watched First Man.
When I was watching First Man, I felt that, my God, how did they do this? How was this accomplished? I thought that was brought beautifully to the screen in First Man.
Now, I'd like to say something about First Man. So you and I have talked about First Man.
Yes.
So you know what I think. So I was on a panel. Actually, it was interesting because both in Tucson and here in Des Moines, Jim Hansen was at both of these events. So we got a chance to hang out for a few hours. And Jim Hansen wrote First Man and co-produced the movie.
Right.
But I said, Jim, I haven't seen you for a while. I have a bunch of questions. He kind of grinned and said, yeah. And I said, first of all, you know, Buzz, and he said, yeah, that was a little rougher in the movie than it was in the book.
Right.
And I said, but okay, that aside. So the tone of the film, you know, the book is pretty neutral on Neil in terms of tone because it's not that kind of book. You know, it's a biography, but it doesn't go into that kind of emotional tone.
Right, right.
And I said, I felt like the movie was not tonally ponderous, but dark. It really dwelt on the death of his daughter and really showed him to be almost a dark character. And I said, you know, you spent 55 hours interviewing him, which was extraordinary.
Yeah.
Nobody else had done that.
Right.
You know, I just know him for the downlink and the interviews and so forth. And I said, but he seemed to be a much lighter person than that. The other astronauts I know that spent time with him said that he was almost jocular. You know, he's quiet, but he was very engaging, had a great sense of humor, was a lot of fun. And if you listen to the downlink from the Apollo 11 mission, he was having a great time up there, and so was Buzz. And Jim said, yeah, it was a directorial great creative choice. And he said it was a certain story, but it wasn't the one I wrote. And I thought, okay, well, that's fair.
Yeah. Well, it's Hollywood. You know, you've worked there, Rod.
Yeah, not on movies like that, but just on other stuff. And, yeah, you take creative licenses. I mean, one thing I hate in documentaries is when they start messing around with the facts. That's really not good. So right. I'm looking forward, I hope, to a couple of accurate Apollo 11 movies here.
All right, and we're going to talk about your Apollo 11 book a little bit later on, but we got to take a break here, Rod. When we come back, we got some news stories to talk about, space-related and all that cool stuff. Hang on, Rod, okay?
All right, there you go.
Rod Pyle is with us, a space expert, author, speaker. He's the best, written a ton of books, and we've got two right in front of me that are fantastic, and we'll talk more about that as well. We got to take a break for the news here on 720 WGN. More with Rod Pyle after that. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we are here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Thursday. It means Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We are going to be talking a bunch of 90s topics, a lot of fun 90s topics in honor of the release of Captain Marvel, which takes place in 1995. Excited to see that decade come back to life. We'll jump into that later on. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Facebook.com/Nick D Show is a great way to stay connected as well. Our guest is our good friend Rod Pyle, who is the author of many books. He is an expert on space, speaker, author, all kinds of cool stuff. And we got some space-related stories to talk about, and we're going to dive into his two new books as well. And here's Rod Pyle. Hi, Rod.
Yeah, hello.
All right, welcome back. SpaceX was in the news again a couple of days ago. It's really funny. I just had, Rod, I have you on. You're a regular guest, usually like monthly and stuff. And I have a car expert named Tom Appel who joins me once a month. And so we get to talk about Elon Musk in two different ways. When Tom's on, we talk about the car angle. And when you're on, we talk about the space angle. So we get to cover the two big angles of Elon Musk. And Tom actually was on earlier this week. Now we can talk about Elon Musk from this angle now. So SpaceX... SpaceX made the news big time a couple days ago.
Yeah, so finally launched this long-awaited test of the Crew Dragon on the Falcon 9, and this is the space capsule that we hope will return an American capability to carry our astronauts up to what is largely our space station. And very successful. Launched on time, which isn't something we're used to seeing with complicated human-rated spacecraft like this. made it up the space station, docked autonomously, which is something that we were looking forward to. Because up till now, when SpaceX has launched these cargo missions, they would go up and rendezvous with the space station, get grabbed by the Canadarm, and then brought in and berthed that way. This actually flew right up, docked without a hitch, and the astronauts are able to go inside and remove stuff, and a little plushy toy floated out because it's SpaceX. They do cool things like that.
Right.
And so far it's going well. So within a few months, hopefully by the beginning of summer, we should see the first flight with a crew. The one thing that still got a few people concerned, and I was chatting with some of the astronauts today about this, was that SpaceX has this unique fueling method for their rockets that United Launch Alliance and Boeing, who is the competitor that's going to be launching very soon as well with their Starliner capsule, that's a traditional thing where you fuel the rocket and it sits there and stabilized and ready and everything checks out. Then the astronauts go and they launch. On the Falcon 9, to get a little more power, they super chill this fuel, which means they have to put it in at the very last moment to prevent excessive boil-off and so forth. So the crew gets in the rocket, and then they pump the fuel in. And as you remember, a couple of years ago, they were doing that, and the rocket exploded on the pad because delamination in a tank of helium inside one of the fuel tanks. Now, supposedly that's been addressed, and everything's been cleaned up and fixed. And at least in theory, had there been a crew in there and had the abort system on the capsule been armed, it would have taken off before that explosion would have killed anybody. But we don't know. And that's microsecond timing. You know, that's got to send something right away.
Yeah,
and then you are popped off of there in a great big hurry and people can get hurt and so forth. So don't want that to happen. So looking forward to more tests. But this is a huge milestone. And if we could just, you know, Elon and one other guy in our government, if we could just get them to tweet a little bit less, we would see a little less news on them, and they wouldn't get in trouble with things like the SEC.
Yeah.
Why, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And we would, you know, it's funny because on the car angle, Tesla's been taking some hits lately, too, you know, in that regard. You know, they're closing down the actual, they're closing down, like, a bunch of the actual auto
stores, right?
Yeah, the stores, and you know, because they're convinced that people will buy cars just online, which I just find very, very strange.
Have you been to a Tesla showroom?
Oh no, I have not.
So I finally went in with my girlfriend a while ago, and I said, "Yeah, she doesn't like looking at cars because you know, just doesn't. It's a guy thing, right?
Right, right."
But we were walking through past the old town. I said, "Let's check it out." So we go inside. And it does make quite a statement. I mean, I like the idea of Teslas. I've seen them on the road, but to be able to go in and get a tour of the inside of that thing, see all the little details that they got right inside and out.
Yeah.
But then you sit in it. This is a Model 3, and you've got what we would have in the old days called a color TV sitting in the middle of the console. And the design of the software that operates the thing is what really blew me away. So, for instance, air conditioning vents. What do you do on most cars? Well, you got a little roller valve, and then you aim it the right direction.
Right.
This one has an image of the air conditioning vents on the display screen, the video screen, and you sort of swipe your hand across to the direction you want the air to go, and then it illustrates it following your fingers, and the next thing you know, you got air blowing in your face.
Wow.
You know, not having a showroom, risky choice, but he's a risk taker.
He is. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, our car expert, Tom, has been to a Tesla showroom, and he says it's pretty cool. He thinks it's pretty cool. So,
yeah, it really makes a statement that I don't think you can make online, but, you know,
hey,
he's fooled us before.
He has. So what's next for SpaceX?
Well, like I said, in a few months, they're going to get their first crew up there, and about the same time, we should see, and I haven't seen news on this lately, but they had their subscale version of the Starship, which we used to call BFR, the Big Falcon Rocket.
Right, right.
Before that, we called it the Interplanetary Colonial Transporter, and before that, we called it Elon's Madness, you know.
Right, right.
So they have a subscale version of that. They switched from composites to stainless steel. And that's something that you see in private industry, especially with SpaceX. They're very nimble, and they make these switches very quickly. And the last thing I had heard, it was going to be made out of composites, and then bam, you see this big stainless steel thing with rivet all over it, and you go, looks like a science fiction rocket. Oh, that's the BFR, okay. Got damaged in a windstorm, and they're fixing that, and that will fly probably in about 3 to 4 months if they stay on schedule. And that's just a hop test. But when I say just a hop test, I mean, it goes up quite far and then comes back down vertically, so it tests the liftoff and landing. And if that's successful, then within a couple of years, we should see full-scale testing of the BFR. And that, Starship. And that not only leads towards, you know, lunar flights and heavy cargo up to orbit and great reusability and incredible economies of scale and all that, but also this thing we've talked about before, which is point-to-point going from L.A. to Shanghai in a matter of hours, you know. So I think 39 minutes or something.
Wow.
And he claims at what would be about the same as a first-class ticket today. And I just read also that Virgin, which we're going to talk about because they've had another test flight, has made a deal with a company, I think called Boom Technologies, to start building smaller versions of what you might consider to be an updated Concorde to do supersonic flight point-to-point from places in the United States to Asia and Australia and so forth. So, you know, this could be a whole new era of aviation. Going to be a little tougher because you're talking with the FAA. This isn't accepting high risk for space flight. This is commercial air transport, and that's a whole different set of rules. So that'll be an interesting conversation.
Yeah. Well, listen, you mentioned Virgin Galactic. Let's talk about that. Something big happened just this past week.
Yeah, so it was on the 22nd of February. They had another test flight. First time they've carried more than just two pilots. So a woman who's their head astronaut trainer went on it. And they reached Mach 3, which was a record. And they got up to the altitude they wanted and were able to have the woman passenger unclip and kind of drift around the cabin like the passengers in the future are supposed to do if you paid your, I think now it's $250,000 for the flight.
Right.
And she's able to try the various restraints and make sure that nobody's going to get hurt and see how that was going to work. And then, of course, they did their wacky reentry with that tail that folds up. It's called feathering to slow it down and aim it in the proper trajectory.
Right.
And it went really well. So, you know, they're building up this very constant cadence of test flights. Still just have one finished vehicle to work with, but assuming everything goes the way they want, they're working on at least one more, possibly two. And, you know, they hope to have a fleet of these things deployed globally for both recreational use and research. They've got a couple of small contracts with NASA for doing short-term microgravity flights and things like that. So, you know, they're moving ahead, and God bless them. I mean, Branson was predicting this in 2007 and 2009 and 2013, 2015, and kept saying it's close, it's close, it's close. And George Whitesides, who's the president of his company, kept saying, you know, let's just stop giving dates. We'll get there when we get there.
Right.
And he used to run the National Space Society, so he's somebody we all know and love and really smart, wonderful guy. And he said, you know, we just need to really keep at it, keep our nose to the grindstone, and just get it right, you know. And they're a small operation and, you know, nothing on the scale of SpaceX. So they're just chipping away at it. And I think in the next year, year and a half, we'll see some revenue flights coming.
There you go. Okay, it's Virgin Galactic. All right, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, we got more space stories to talk about with Rod Pyle. You can check out pylebooks.com, P-Y-L-E books, pylebooks.com. And he's got two new books, one coming out in April, one that's out now, and we'll talk about those as well. Much more to talk about with Rod Pyle right after this. Right. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here till 5 a.m. It's Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday. One artist, three songs. Get your requests in now. Play them later. 312-981-7200. My guest right now is Rod Pyle, space expert, author, speaker. Written a bunch of books. He's got two new ones, one that's out right now, one that comes out in April, and we'll talk about those. And we always talk about some space stories. So let's get back to our conversation with Rod Pyle. Hi, Rod.
We are back. Hi there.
Hi. So the first mole on Mars had a little had a little issue.
Yeah, funny way to put it. Yeah. The Mars InSight lander set down last year, started operations this year. Seismometer was one main instrument to measure Mars quakes, and that was deployed and just slowly being calibrated and was showing solid results. So that's happy. The second instrument, the mole, which is a heat flow experiment, Mm-hmm. is another package they set down the surface with a robotic arm, and it's supposed to unspool a 16-foot-long mechanical rope, basically, a tube, that has a self-hammering armature in the end of it, and is supposed to whack itself down on the surface to, they hope, a depth of 16 feet. So they got down about a foot and a half, I think, almost 2 feet, and hit a rock, which they, you know, they expected that would happen. There's a lot of rocks on the surface, even though it's mostly softer soil. So it did what it was supposed to do, diverted around that, and then nudged up against another rock. And at that point, they had reached their four-hour limit for a single hammering session and decided to call it quits and run some simulations and try and figure out if they're doing the right thing. So it's deep enough now that it can start doing some of its work. So half of the experiments it does, or half of the experimental process, is sending out heat pulses from that tether, that mole, and seeing how they dissipate in the dirt to give them a better idea of the soil dynamics below the surface, hopefully more than a foot, ultimately. And then once it's fully extended, assuming it does get fully extended, it goes passive and measures the heat coming out of the planet, which tells you a lot about the makeup of the planet, the core, how temperature flows out of the planet, tells you a whole lot about its structure. You know, there could be a lot of rocks down there. I don't know how much further they're going to get, and it's got to be a real nail-biter for those guys because they've been working on this almost $900 million mission for a long time. And yeah, they knew it was high risk, but we hope it'll work. You know, if not, maybe they can move the thing and try again.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, let's get into your I want to talk about your books before we run out of time. You mentioned Space 2.0 and the book First on the Moon, which is the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience. Again, both books have forewords by Buzz Aldrin. Let's talk about Space 2.0. You've talked a little bit about it in the past. What are some of the things that you wanted to get across with this one?
I think, you know, if I had to put it in a nutshell, it's an attempt to write a layman accessible handbook for the new space age. So we had our first space age, which lasted from 1957 till arguably the end of the shuttle era, which is 2011. And we accomplished a lot. We got some of the heavy lifting out of the way. We picked the low-hanging fruit, you know, pick your metaphor. We got first missions to the moon and so forth. And now it's time for that next big step. And we've been in for the last handful of years, flying with the Russians, continuing with the space station. We call that sort of Space 1.5. I think the breaking point for 2.0 for me, this is arguable, was the launch of the Falcon Heavy, because we got this kind of eccentric billionaire who said, I want to build rockets. I want to change the way we fly rockets. I want to change the way this market works. Jeff Bezos, same thing, actually started a little earlier than Musk. And these two guys are really changing the dynamics of this industry in so many ways, especially and including the fact that they're forcing the old-school aerospace contractors like Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman and so forth to kind of reevaluate the way they've been doing business and get more competitive and get a little leaner and meaner. And it was time for that. So this is going to allow so many things to happen. If you make access to space cheaper, you start getting more material up there and ultimately more machines and more people to do necessary and interesting things. And then when you start being able to put some infrastructure up there, which is another thing the book looks at in some depth, orbital tankers, you start utilizing resources on the moon to mine water ice and metal and get oxygen out of the rocks, which you can do, and so forth. Now, this is all stuff you don't have to carry up there at great expense and effort anymore, and you can start really achieving things. You can build machines there to go further. You can build habitats. You can get people up there doing things that only people can do well. And this is really a new era, and it happens cheaper and more effectively than it has ever happened before. So that's what we're talking about.
Obviously these developments have been pretty amazing. As someone who's been following the space program for as long as you have, this has got to be sort of a renaissance period, right?
It is, you know, and there's been a long period of frustration, which started as the Apollo missions were winding down. And back then, you know, if you were a young adult listening to that, you were told we were going to have Mars in 10 years. And I was talking again to those Apollo astronauts today, and they said, look, we thought the same thing. You know, we drank the Kool-Aid, and we thought we were going to be out to Mars and developing the asteroid belt and have a base on the moon and so forth. And it all kind of stopped. And part of it was because we ran out of the political willpower. We weren't pushing against the Soviet Union anymore. We don't really have another superpower. Arguably, China could fit that role ultimately, but hopefully we'll be in cooperation or at least competition with them instead of just being arch competitors. And Apollo was kind of a closed-end program. It was designed to get to the moon quickly, do that research, and that was kind of it. And it couldn't do a whole lot else well, at least not the way NASA wanted to use it. So now we're seeing these robust, less expensive, more generalized rockets and spacecraft and systems that will be able to do a variety of things. So, for instance, there's a spacecraft called Zeus, which is going to be flown by ULA, which was able to go up and park in orbit, ACES, sorry, not Zeus, and stay there, and then it's refuelable, and it can be flown back and forth between the Earth and the Moon and do all kinds of tug duty to various positions between those two bodies and perform a lot of tasks that we haven't been able to do affordably. We had to launch a whole rocket for that. Now we can just get up to orbit, transfer the cargo over to this thing, and it'll just act as a space tug. So you start bringing in that kind of infrastructure again. It's kind of a boring word, but it's very important.
Yeah.
And this really does open up a whole new era of things that we can do.
Wow, that's really great. Now let's talk about first on the moon. Let me ask you this: there has to be there's going to be some amazing events happening on July 20th, right? Are they scheduling all kinds of celebrations and stuff?
Oh my lord, yeah. I mean, just the ones I know of. I know that Buzz Aldrin has something going in the Reagan Library in California about that time. National Space Society has a fundraiser gala going on in that same June, I think, in Los Angeles at the Beverly Hilton. There's going to be the Aldrin Family Foundation is doing one in Florida. Those are just the three I've heard of. I'm sure there's at least 5 or 10 others of equal scale and probably many small ones. The U.S. Mint has put out a really cool coin that I just saw today that's got the convex surface on one side of Aldrin's helmet from that famous photograph.
Sure.
And a concave crater on the other side, beautifully done. So, you know, the media and the country is going to kind of go nuts about it for the year. I mean, these anniversaries really should continue till 2022, but I think it'll taper off pretty quick after July.
Yeah, it's going to be, I mean, I would imagine that on July 20th or like the week of that, you probably couldn't find a cable channel that doesn't have something Apollo related. That would be like a special of some kind.
Yeah, there's a bunch of those. CNN's got stuff in the works. I think Time does also. But in addition to that, there's two other things. One is, I don't know who's doing it, but I heard just the other day that there's going to be a media outlet online that's going to be showing the recordings from the mission, vis-a-vis news and the moonwalks and so forth, as they actually happen, timed out so that it peaks on July 20th, which would be really cool.
That's cool.
And then, that is cool. And then the magazine I edit at Astra will be coming out in a publicly available edition that is going to be, and there will be other magazines, of course, but this is the one I think will be best.
Right.
all Apollo 11 and associated stuff. So I got a bunch of stories with some really skilled writers, and we've got an augmented reality component and so forth. So that'll be neat. And of course, you'll get copies of that.
Awesome. That's great.
Because you're a friend of the family.
I appreciate that. Before we let you go, as I mentioned before, this is a really, First on the Moon is a really just a gorgeous coffee table book. Where did some of these images and these pictures and illustrations come from? I mean, wow. I mean, you really went out of your way here.
Well, it's my job, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of them are on the high-res archives online. Then there were a huge release of previously unposted photographs that you could have found if you riffled through the archives, but a lot of them were, you know, an accidental exposure of a moon boot or a crooked horizon or something. So I hired a graphic artist to go in who was experienced with space imagery and grab a bunch of those that were otherwise unusable and composite them together and even them out and adjust the color temperature and make them beautiful. So I think there's 12 of those in there. So they haven't been seen in that context. So that's kind of exciting. And then, as I said, I got some other photographs that I had from my own personal collection and people that I knew. So, it's a deep dive into the subject. And then I think my favorite part, though, was, and we've talked about this on air before, was talking to the kids, both the Armstrong and Aldrin boys, and having Andy Aldrin tell me that his main concern when his father was on lunar surface wasn't about his health and welfare, but was that he didn't want him to trip over one of those cables and embarrass him in front of his schoolmates. And I thought, you know, that sounds like a teenager. It sounds like my teenager. So, yeah why not?
That's
so that was cool.
Yeah, very, very cool. It's a great book, man. Really, really beautiful. What's the actual
date?
It comes out in April, correct?
April 2nd.
Okay, April 2nd. First on the moon, and you can get all the information at pilebooks.com. Again, you did a great job, Rod. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Stay warm there in Iowa.
I'll do my best. You stay warm there in Chicago, my friend.
Thank you, buddy. We'll talk to you soon, okay?
Take care. Thanks.
Okay, cool. There, Rod Pyle. Anytime we talk space, we talk with Rod Pyle. He's a speaker and a great author. His two new books, Space 2.0, available now, and a beautiful coffee table celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission, First on the Moon. A really, really beautiful book. Check out all the information for this and more at pilebooks.com. That's P-Y-L-E, pilebooks.com. All right, we'll take a break for the news right here on 720 WGN.